Hello, friends. It's The Environment Show, and welcome. The great flood of 1993 continues long after the rains have ceased and the floodwaters receded way down the river. Out in the Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippi continues to wreak havoc. Also, performing CPR on your lawn. And there's good news and bad news regarding our nation's rivers. But says Kevin Coyle, one thing is for sure.
What I always say is that when I look at my children, I see individuals who are two-thirds river water. And that's true across the country, but even our bodies are made up of river water. And not all that many people are very aware of that.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Though most people who lost homes and businesses during the great flood of 93 may never be able to forget the experience nor fully recover, most of the homes and businesses will likely be rebuilt and life will go on. Meanwhile, most have forgotten a basic scientific principle, namely, rivers flow downhill to the sea. Refrigerators, tires, clothing, animal carcasses, farm chemicals, industrial waste, including heavy metals, and even raw sewage from failed treatment plants. All of it was carried away in the swirling torrent. All of it destined for one place, the Gulf of Mexico.
The river discharge peaks at the amount of the river, usually in April. And it starts to go down in May and June, and usually during July, August, and September, the river flow at the mouth of the river is usually the lowest for the year.
Dr. Nancy Rabelais, one of the lead scientists with the Louisiana University Marine Consortium of Cocodrie, Louisiana, southwest of New Orleans. Dr. Rabelais has been working since 1985 on a program funded by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to test the level of nutrients in both the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico. As she said, under normal circumstances, the water flow and the nutrients in it begin to drop off by early summer.
This year, it never did really stop. So we had this sustained freshwater flow and sustained high nutrient inputs for the whole summer, which we don't normally have. And so the system got extra doses of fresh water and nutrients this year at a time when it doesn't normally get them. So we never did really get what I call a typical summertime situation in the Gulf this summer. It was like spring. It's like a spring flood all summer long.
This, of course, brought on by the torrential, unrelenting rains upriver. Dr. Rabelais says the rich nutrient flow down the river is a good thing to a point. It is responsible for rendering the Gulf one of the richest for fish and shellfish. But she says there is a saturation point. Too much of a good thing and the water becomes choked. The oxygen drops and both fish and plants die. Normally, nutrients peak just in time to prevent the die-off. Not this summer. All the chemical agriculture uses, even homeowners who use to stimulate crops and gardens, end up in super high concentration in the river water, only to end up in the Gulf.
This year, the size of the low oxygen zone was at least twice as big as what we normally map in the middle of the summer since I've been doing this since 1985, so it's substantially larger.
And how big is twice as big?
Okay, in terms of aerial coverage, we're estimating right now that all the data aren't in and exactly calculated, but 6,700 square miles. And it's usually between 3,000 to 4,000 square miles per area that we map in midsummer. So it's obviously twice as big.
Is there anything that you might be, what is that comparable to give us an idea sort of on a land mass? How much water is that covering?
Well, we did some rough calculations while we were still at sea steaming back in, and to put it in terms of things that were relevant at the time, the state of Iowa, which was being flooded so severely at the time, the low oxygen zone was 12% the size of the state of Iowa. And we also looked up a few other things. It's the size of the state of New Jersey. And in terms of a large estuary, Chesapeake Bay on the east coast of the U.S., the low oxygen zone we mapped this summer was 2 times the size of the Chesapeake Bay area.
Dr. Rabelais says in the scheme of things, this is not a large area compared to the entire Gulf of Mexico, obviously, but it is the largest low oxygen area in any body of water mapped to date. And this is of concern to the scientific world, in the short run and for the long run.
The long-term effects of what we saw this summer will actually be very difficult to document because there are, for instance, commercial fisheries catch data. Over the long term, is so variable and influenced by so many factors that it would be hard to pinpoint exactly what the size of the low oxygen zone did this year to the shrimp catch this year and next year as well. So it's a fairly nebulous data set. It's hard to put your finger on it exactly, but there are some ways to look at long-term effects, but it's a little difficult to say exactly what's going to cause those effects that you're going to see. The Mississippi River, the overall lower salinities that we saw across the whole coastal zone this summer affects the shrimp nursery area. It's not just the low oxygen zone that was offshore at the exact time and place that the shrimp were spawning. That's another issue, and the migration of the shrimp in and out of the nurseries was affected by the location of the low oxygen zone. So there's a broad spectrum of effects that the flooding had on, like, for instance, the shrimp fishery that may affect it, but it's actually very difficult to do a direct cause and effect relationship study.
The Mississippi River drains some 41% of the North American landmass, affecting even land in Canada. To address the issue of water pollution, then, requires a multilateral approach: international, federal, state, local, business, and the citizenry.
The impacts of changes in nutrients on the nearshore coastal zone, I think we're getting a pretty good idea that as we're changing the nutrients in the river, which we are, that's very well documented. The nitrates have gone up. The phosphate loading has gone up, the silicates have gone down, the ratios have changed. We've made large-scale changes in the water quality of the river, just on the nutrients. And if we can see these translations into ecosystem changes in the Gulf of Mexico, I think we need to take heed, because other coastal waters, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, where they are adjacent to large rivers where there are either organic or nutrient loadings, I mean, they've suffered, and the resources that depend on those coastal waters have suffered as well. So we don't need to stand back and wait. I don't think we should stand back and wait to find out that our resources are in jeopardy before we try to manage our system. The problem is our system is so huge and crosses so many territorial boundaries, state and, you know, any kind of water district management. But there are things that we, the collective we, the citizenry, could do, which would include practical land use practices and taking care of our discharges and confining non-point sources and reducing sediment loads and reducing organic loading and reducing whatever sorts of noxious chemicals might be getting in the river.
Dr. Nancy Rabelais, associate professor and one of the lead scientists at the Louisiana University Marine Consortium located in Cocotree, Louisiana. We spoke with representatives of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the United States Geologic Survey, and representatives of the Louisiana state government. All are in accordance with the findings of the Marine Consortium. Though these studies monitored only the levels of nutrients, other materials, including toxic chemicals, came down the river. They, and all the rest of the debris carried by the raging water, have not yet been investigated with respect to their long-term impact on the Gulf Coast. We are told studies are underway. We are told results will be available. You will have them when we have them. This is Bruce Robertson. Now here's an ironic fact. There is your lawn out there under the sun and stars year in and year out, getting nothing but the freshest air. Okay, so the lawn doesn't look all that great all the time, even though it has the best fertilizers helping it along. But it does have fresh air, right? Wrong, says Larry Somke, the environmental gardener. True, the lawn does need air, but chances are it's not getting it, despite being outdoors year-round. Larry says the lawn may need a little lawn CPR.
Larry, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right now.
I can't figure out what you're doing. You're either taking your frustrations out or doing some kind of mining or digging for lost gold or something. What are you doing?
I'm definitely taking my frustrations out, but I'm also aerating my lawn.
Ah.
Yes, and what I'm using is an ordinary forked spade,
like a pitchfork.
Yeah, four-tined spade, and I'm just taking it and I'm just banging it down into the ground by hand and seeing about how deep I can get it down there.
This is called aerating.
This is called aerating because what we're doing here is poking little holes in the ground, in the turf, in the lawn here, so that air can actually get down deeper into the soil. Air, moisture, fertilizer that I put down fertilizer here about two or three weeks ago, and so that can now sort of seep down into the soil. You know, when you have a vegetable garden, every year you go in there and rototill it or dig it up by hand, and you get air in there, and that helps the microorganisms live, that helps loosen up the soil, it helps the organic matter to break down. But with a lawn, you can't just go out and dig up your lawn every year, although I dug up my lawn and planted grass, a couple months ago, but ordinarily people don't dig up their lawn. And if they've been using a lot of chemical fertilizers and abusing their lawn for the last few years, the lawn can get very compacted, and the turf itself can get, you can get a lot of thatch on the turf and various things
you're
like that.
Break it up then.
So you're breaking it up, mm-hmm. You can go out there and aerate it, and your lawn will recover a lot better.
Now, there must be a little bit of science to what you're doing. For example, how much do you do it? What's the distance between each poke?
Well, I have to have a life besides doing this, I do it about every 12 inches. I just go along about every 12 inches and just do it like this, get it in there and try to get it down as deep as I can. My lawn's not in too bad a shape, but it's interesting to find that I'm doing this aerating, I get underground here about an inch or two, and I'm finding lots of stone and shale and rock and things like that, which are not good for lawn. You can see in this part of my lawn, it's not growing really well, so this aeration could help me a lot.
I've seen a lot of people, Larry, with what looks like a cylinder, a small drum that has tines on it, and either it's something that can be hand-pushed or pulled or maybe even drawn on the back of a tractor, like a lawnmower,
right.
Tractor mower. Is that, are they doing the same thing? Is that
yes.
An aerator?
They're aerating, that's right. And if you have a lawn, I can get away doing this with this little tiny pitchfork because I have a small postage stamp size lawn. But if you have a lawn that's large enough that where you would have to use a riding mower on it, you definitely should get some of that equipment that you can either attach to your riding mower, or you can actually buy other types of aerators that are like lawn mowers. You can just run them over your lawn like a lawn mower, and it sucks out these, pokes these little holes in there and pulls out these little core samples of soil, maybe 2 or 3 inches deep, and it plops them all over your lawn. And actually, fall is a very good time to or aerate your lawn because you have all these little cores of dirt all over the lawn. It's a great time for it. They'll decompose and they'll go away and the rains will come. You wouldn't want to do it in June. But there's other ways you can do it. Actually, if you have a golfer in your family, a golfer can just put on his or her golf shoes and walk around on the lawn.
Oh, so that's why golf courses always look so good.
Well, it might be that in the lawn care professionals that take care of it. But golf shoes will do the same thing. It'll just poke little holes all over in your lawn and allow the air and the moisture and the fertilizer to get down in there and have a better looking lawn.
Okay, Larry, poke away.
All right.
See you next time.
Yeah, just don't call me a slowpoke.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens, will leave him to poke more holes in his backyard in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Before the flames could be extinguished, 7 bridges across the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland were burned and destroyed. Firefighters had a difficult time extinguishing the blaze. The accelerant was the river itself. The water, so full of oil, gasoline, and other combustible chemicals, the water caught fire. But that was 1969. Today, says Kevin Coyle, president of the river conservation group American Rivers, we have come pretty far downstream.
I think there are a couple pieces of good news about the health of America's rivers. The first of those being that since the National Wild and Scenic Rivers System was established in 1968, there has been a decline in the number of large-sized dams that have been built across the country. Moreover, a lot of the rivers that were being diverted, the water was being taken out of them for agricultural purposes and so forth, are being less drained by agriculture. So there's fewer dams and there's less drainage of the rivers for agriculture. So that's some of the good news. And second, the Clean Water Act was passed in the early 1970s. And so a lot of the industrial wastes and the sewage and so forth that was going into America's rivers has stopped. We've cleaned up a lot of America's rivers on those problems. So there are a couple pieces of good news there about rivers and the health of rivers.
But, says Coyle, we should restrain ourselves from becoming too self-congratulatory. Not only do we have a long way to go with our old problems before we can say our rivers are truly fresh and clear, in the meantime, new problems have arrived, so that in a sense, we have a whole new ballgame.
There was some alarming news that came forward about 2.5 years ago concerning fisheries in the United States. And what it showed, this was a study that was done by the Nature Conservancy, and it showed that a third of the freshwater fish species of the United States are threatened. And this is a rate of endangerment that's much higher than land-based species, such as, you know, animals crossing the country. And that's a real problem. The fish are dying faster, and then when we look at the Pacific Northwest, we see that many of the salmon species out there are also declining very rapidly. So when we pay attention to what's happening with rivers and we look at the species that live within them, we realize that there are some problems with rivers. And one of those is that while we've solved some of the problems of industrial pollution and sewage going into rivers, there are problems related to agriculture and to spraying of lawn chemicals and so forth. And this is called non-point source pollution. That is, there's no particular pipe that is stuck in the river putting waste material into it, but rather every time it rains, the runoff from that rain that goes into the river is causing problems. And that's now the leading cause of pollution.
There is even a third major threat to our river, says Coyle. Here the problem is not the river itself, but an area along the river bank called the riparian zone. This is the distance in from the river water itself, where plants and animals live affected by and reliant upon the river. An example, the distance a beaver will travel up from the river onshore to gather wood. This riparian zone is in trouble.
And that area is being cut and degraded and developed, and highways are built on it, and so forth. And if we can keep the riparian areas, the near-stream environment, intact, there's food for fisheries, the water is cooler. It helps to filter off the pollutants that run from the land into the rivers. And the problem that we're facing is that as a nation, we're not understanding the importance of that riparian area for the future of rivers across the country.
Coyle and his organization are calling for new and better legislation to address some of these problems that we did not know about 10 or 15 years ago. And with work to begin on renewing the Clean Water Act, we probably will see action on the federal, state, and local level that will control non-point source pollution, for example, or zoning that will control what we do along the riverbank. But in the end, Coyle says, we are going to need something else altogether.
There really needs to be a sea change, if you will, in the way that individuals think about rivers. And what I always say is that when I look at my children, I see individuals who are two-thirds river water. And that's true across the country, but even our bodies are made up of river water, and not all that many people are very aware of that. If they are aware of it, they think that the water's safe for drinking, and in a lot of cases it isn't. But we need to begin better educating individuals as to the importance of, of healthy rivers to clean water, point one. And point two, to make people aware that if nature is to survive, we need to keep the veins and arteries of the system intact. And the rivers and streams of the country are the veins and arteries of the country as well.
For us to move better educated into the future to accomplish this necessary sea change, Coyle says it would be useful to know exactly where we have done it right and exactly where we have done it all wrong.
I think there are examples of rivers in the country that are success stories. They're stories of rivers that were very badly degraded but have become much healthier and better cleaned up over the years. One of those rivers is in Ohio, and it's called the Cuyahoga River. And it was famous in the 1960s because it was so polluted at that point with industrial waste and petroleum products and so forth that there was a point at which the river actually caught on fire. And that was a signal to the country that we needed to really try to the extent possible, to improve the rivers. And today the Cuyahoga is much cleaner and much healthier as a river.
Would you say, Kevin, let me interrupt there for a second. Would you say that as an example of a truly cleaned up river, is it clean enough to put your big toe in take off municipal drinking water?
The Cuyahoga is definitely clean enough to put your big toe in, but it's not a pristine river, and it's a long way from getting there. And I think that's true of many of the success stories. They were so badly degraded through the first part of this century that it's going to take much, much more to say that they are now fully a healthy river. I think another example of a river that is much closer to being a healthy river is the Potomac River here in where I am in Washington, D.C. And back in the 1960s and 70s, the Potomac was considered to be one of the worst rivers in the country. It had pollution from sewage and industry and so forth going into it. And now it's a much cleaner river. It has healthy wetlands. Its fishery has improved very dramatically. There's bird life up and down the river. And in general, the Potomac is a much cleaner river, but even it has a long way to go yet.
Earlier, we discussed non-point source pollution as the leading cause of water pollution today. Where this is found in heavy activity, there also we find the worst rivers. Not surprisingly, the heaviest activity is in the Midwest, where we find the worst river.
The Mississippi, which of course is the largest river in the country, is undergoing this kind of slow deterioration because of the chemical waste that goes into it. And so the Mississippi, particularly in its lower part, has become so bad that some environmentalists have referred to the lower Mississippi as Cancer Alley because it contains so many chemicals.
Finally, as we move into the final years of this century and open a new millennium, Coyle says we need a new vision about rivers.
And that vision is different from the vision that we might have had 30 years ago. The vision that we're developing now goes beyond the quality of water in those rivers to look at the rivers as a whole and to say that we need to protect river ecosystems. We need to protect river watersheds. And by watersheds, I mean the river from its headwaters, its source, down to its mouth. And that's what's developing as the high energy way of thinking about rivers in today's world.
Kevin Coyle, president of the conservation group American Rivers. He spoke to us from the organization's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show for this week. We thank you much for joining us, and be sure to tune in next week at this time. We'll do it all again. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, drop us a line, address your questions and your comments to The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 200. We had help this week from Tracy O'Connell. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.